You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 15th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, senior editor at the New Republic, Jonathan Cohn, will be here to talk Obamacare. But before we get to Obamacare, it's boner care. I'm sorry. Boner care. A bipartisan plan comes out of the Senate and runs into a brick wall that is known as the U.S. House of Representatives. What's in that Senate bill? Does it matter? Will we go full vitter? Yes, folks. Sorry, said that. That's why we have the explicit rating on the show. Also on the program, more on the effects of the shutdown and a viral video of Chris Van Hollen revealing that the Republicans had basically shut the escape hatch before launching into this government shutdown. Meanwhile, in New York State and maybe around the country, kindergarten kids having to take standardized tests to evaluate their teachers. Just how bizarre things have gotten in this school reform movement. JP Morgan, meanwhile, our buddy Jamie Dimon, just countdown until CNBC brings Alex Perrine back on and apologizes. They spend more money on legal fees than they do the rest of their business. New report shows that a safety net, you conservatives may want to have a sit down on this one, a generous safety net makes for happier citizens. Who could have known, except for everyone with a half a brain? And another new report show that women engage in less corporate corruption, and apparently they also make less off it. All that and more on today's program. This just breaking from the Supreme Court. They've agreed to decide whether to block key aspects of the Obama administration's plan aimed at cutting power plant and factory emissions of the gases blamed for global warming. You'll recall that President Obama took some executive actions, some that were basically in the pipeline, several months ago, faced with the House's refusal to believe that global warming exists, because apparently God told them it didn't. The Supreme Court will review the unanimous federal appeals court ruling that upheld the government's ability to regulate six different heat-trapping gases. The question is whether or not the EPA has the authority to regulate automobile emissions of greenhouse gases as air pollutants. This stemmed from a 2007 Supreme Court ruling. The question is whether or not the EPA, if they can regulate those greenhouse gases coming out of cars, whether they also can do so to power plants and factories. This is a big issue in terms of whether or not the administration can do anything unilaterally to stem greenhouse gases. The EPA has this authority under the Clean Air Act. And then we'll see when this case comes up. I believe it'll be in 2014. Early in 2014 as to whether or not the EPA has this authority. Anybody want to take a guess as to whether or not the Roberts Court will somehow find that greenhouse gases coming out of cars is materially different than those coming out of factories, and therefore the EPA has no authority to prevent worldwide catastrophe? Sorry. We'll send it back to Congress and let them formulate a new formula. Good luck with that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Before we do, our podcast awards nomination still. Today is the last day, folks. It is now or never. We need your nominations. You can nominate us once for People's Choice and once for Politics and News over at podcastawards.com. The voting will start in about 2 weeks, and then you can vote every day. But you can't vote for us if we're not nominated. We've won this award 2 years running. So if we don't get it this year, it's going to make it look like the podcast has gotten worse. And I know none of you believe that. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Jonathan Cohn. Hey, Majority Report listeners, you know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to getting sponsors for the show. And I can't say enough about Credo Mobile. They're our newest sponsor. They're the only progressive cell phone company in the country. This is really the best of both worlds for me. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, holds Democrats accountable, funds the progressive movement, fights climate change, and helps keep this show on the air. It's really easy to sign up right now. Go to credomobile.com/Sam to get 25% off your data for the first 2 years. You get true unlimited data, and they'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers. Look, they're supporting the show, they're a great product, and they do great political work. It's a win-win-win. Go to credomobile.com/Sam to get that deal right now. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, the senior editor of the New Republic, Jonathan Cohn. Welcome back to the program, Jonathan.
Oh, thanks for having me on such an exciting day.
Indeed. Well, I think what we'll do is we will. This interview will be a little metaphor for what's going on in some respects. When we first booked you, we thought we would be talking exclusively about Obamacare. The government shutdown would have ended. The debt ceiling would crashing through it would have been averted, but. No such luck, and I guess luck really has little to do with it. So last night, the Senate forged a deal. Tell us a little bit about what that deal is, was, depending on, I guess, what minute of the hour it is right now.
Right. I think we have to speak in the past tense, or God, it's been a while since I've done grammar, or the conditional tense, because I think the Senate deal last night is now the Senate deal that might have been. You know, just to remind everyone in the background here, you know, House Republicans started this all with Ted Cruz, and, you know, it was going to be about basically we're not going to fund the government, and we're going to let it default unless, you know, the Democrats, basically undermine the health care law. The president, Democrats said, no way. And we got to this standoff, government shut down, default is looming now days away, although exactly when we would start missing payments is a little unclear. Republicans for the last week have been in retreat. Their poll numbers are plummeting. Business is getting angry with them, so they've been looking for a way out. Last night, the action has been in the Senate. Senate Republicans talked to Senate Democrats. They had a deal which basically amounted to reopening the government through January. Extending the debt ceiling through February, and we could talk about the timing later if you want to get into the significance of those dates. It's not, you know, and then basically adding a couple little wrinkles. You know, there was going to be a process to verify the income of people who get subsidies on the new health care exchanges, and there was going to be a change in this reinsurance tax, which I will not bother to explain to you because as of this morning, that's no longer part of the deal.
Okay, so just the income verification, just to be clear, I mean, that was more or less going to happen anyways, right? I mean, it was just a question of it happening on the back end when you file your taxes as opposed to sort of up front.
Right. This has been, you know, this has been one of the big Republican talking points for a while now, is that, oh my gosh, you know, there's going to be all this fraud, and, you know, people are going to be getting subsidies they don't deserve, and, you know, it kind of bleeds into the 47%, the takers, the masses of people who are going to become dependent on government subsidies, yada, yada, yada. Actually, anybody who understood the program understood it was a ridiculous argument. I mean, you go through the computers, which we'll talk about whether they're working or not, but, you know, once the system's working, there's a verification of your IRS return, and, you know, people could lie about certain things, but they would get caught eventually, just like with your taxes. So there was really never an issue here. Republicans had been proposing a new system that would have made would have required a much more aggressive upfront check of income that would have really hobbled things, and that's not what the Democrats were going to do. The Senate deal didn't call for that. What the Senate did said, fine, we'll set up some kind of certification procedure where the Secretary of Health and Human Services will have to certify that there are safety checks in place, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think everybody understood it was really an almost meaningless provision designed so that the Republicans could say, hey, look, we did something on income verification.
Right. This was a fig leaf for the rubes,
yes.
Essentially.
I mean, thin fig leaf.
And the reinsurance was essentially just a way of covering for the insurance companies who may have to take in people who are going to create a riskier risk pool up front and waiting for it all to balance out as younger, healthier people get into the risk pools.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, this is one of those proposals that when you kind of picked it apart, didn't turn out to be, it didn't look like a lot. Because what they were, you know, the like any tax, you know, the money is, like you said, is there to kind of stabilize the insurance pools for these insurers who are suddenly taking on sicker people. The money has to come from somewhere, so it's basically an assessment on existing insurance plans, which could be run by an insurer or, you know, it could be run by an employer or by a union. And the unions were particularly upset about this and have been really urging Congress to kind of give them some relief on it. So the deal, as it was last night, was, all right, it was a little weird, but basically they were going to keep, the insurers need that money to stabilize the pools, and no one wanted to interfere with that. So it was going to keep paying out, but they weren't going to collect the money for another year. So basically, if you imagine, this is like a pool of money, the money was going to start paying out a year before the money started coming in to pay for it, and then a year after it stopped paying out, they'd keep collecting the money, if that makes any sense.
So in other words, there was a little bit of a float that was going to take place, but it's really just an accounting issue at that point.
It is. I mean, no, I think insurers, Sarah Cliff had a piece in the Washington, she's great, she always knows what she's talking about, had a piece in the Washington Post noting that probably the insurers would make a little money off that because they'd get to keep the float. That's exactly what it is. But, you know, didn't sound like a big deal. Again, this was all based on the discussions last night, which never got to the level of putting legislation onto paper. And again, as of this morning, that's not in there anymore, although it could come back.
All right. And so as soon as this deal is announced, the House goes into the Republicans caucus this morning, and apparently the Tea Partiers saw, hey, this is just a bunch of fig leaves. What we really want to do is try and change our congresspeople's pay during the during the session, which, of course, is unconstitutional. And so the House can't seem to figure out what they want to do. Do I have a good sense of that? It's sort of tough to tell.
Yeah, you do have a good sense, probably better than the House leaders. You know, I was watching that press conference with House Speaker Boehner a little while ago, and he looked like a deer in the headlights. I mean, that was, you know, he kind of said a few things, took one question, and ran off. They look totally befuddled and not sure what to do. The latest idea they have now is, all right, you know, they want their piece of Obamacare, and they're not happy with the income verification alone, and they don't think the reinsurance works because somebody must have told them that the unions like it. And, you know, that would be kind of ironic if the Tea Party, you know, got for their troubles, you know, something that the unions like. So they want that out. And instead now, what they want to do is apparently they want to get back to the device tax, right?
Which is, yes, you know, which is also ironic in some respects too, right?
I mean, right. We don't want to do a special interest for the union, so we're going to do a special interest for the medical device industry.
And okay. Explain this device tax, because my understanding of it is it essentially functions as a clawback, right? I mean, the medical device industry is going to make a lot of money off of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, because essentially more people are going to be able to afford their product, so they're going to sell more. But that's not the intention. So that we need that extra cash essentially that they're going to get, skim off that to finance the expansion of things like Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, no, you have it exactly right. I mean, you know, if you go back to when this legislation was crafted, right, there was a set of conversations that happened very early on where the White House and this, you know, Senate, how everyone was writing these bills, they kind of sat down with all the different healthcare industries. I guess you could say it was a little like the Five Families and the Godfather, but, you know, it said, look, we're going to do this reform. We're going to give, you know, and we want you guys to be part of this and to help. And you all need to kind of contribute. Now, the deal was, you're all going to contribute some money, but you're all going to also get something out of the deal, right? Because just like you said, Sam, you know, more people have insurance, they're going to buy your product. So for the device industry, it was, we're going to tax you some, but you're going to make up for that with a new volume because you have insured people who are going to be getting, you know, using more medical equipment, et cetera. The wrinkle here, the two wrinkles are, number one, some of the industries said, yeah, we're into that, we'll sign up, and they made deals, and we may like them, we not. You know, the drug industry famously made a deal, the hospital industry made a deal. The device industry really didn't. They never really played ball. I mean, they just sort of got hit with this tax. It wasn't something so much they negotiated. The other thing is that at the moment, it so happens the device industry is in the middle of a pretty big shakeup, not because of the healthcare law, but just because of how healthcare is changing. And the simple explanation is that hospitals, which buy a lot of medical equipment, right, you know, they're bargaining much harder on prices. So device companies, a lot of them are starting to struggle a little bit. So this tax to them seems like an extra burden they feel like they can't afford. I don't think there's much to those arguments, but that's their claim. So that's what's really going on here. But, you know, in general, I think what you just said is right. Every industry had to give some, but then every industry is going to get some in return. And I see no reason why the device industry can't make the same, you know, basic arrangement that the drug makers and the hospitals and the doctors and, you know, et cetera, have made.
And this is also a fig leaf. I mean, because in many respects, this is something that this is sort of more of a classic transactional, piece of, I guess, an amendment to a legislation, right? Because you have representatives from both sides of the aisle, from all ideologies, who are just basically representing some of their big donors in this instance.
Absolutely correct. This is pure special interest politics. Among the sort of members of Congress who have been agitating to reduce or delay or just get rid of the device tax include a couple of senators who I'm sure are very popular with your listeners. They're popular with me often. Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, Al Franken mm-hmm. in Minnesota. They have been among those sort of asking this because, you know, Massachusetts has big device makers in it. Medtronic, one of the biggest in the United States, is based in Minnesota. And this is pure transactional politics. There are plenty of Democrats who want this, too. Interestingly, the leadership, and I can tell you I was just a little while ago on the phone with people, the leadership in the Senate, in the House, and at the White House, they are trying to hold a line on the device tax. They really don't want it in there. I think partly because there would be some money this would be taking money away from the law, and they tried very hard to make the law fiscally responsible, and that means paying for what they're doing. This is one of the ways they're paying for the expansion, and they don't want to start giving those up. I mean, there's a principle here of, you know, we agreed we were going to pass this law, it was going to spend money in A, B, C, and it was going to collect money in, you know, X, Y, Z. Don't start pulling those pay-fors out. They're part of the law, and we've got to keep them in.
I mean, so the irony here is that if that that part of the law is struck down or is struck out, I guess, pulled out, then the Tea Party has succeeded in making Obamacare more expensive.
That's right. They have, unless they're going to find some offset, but of course they can't, right? I mean, how would you offset it? Well, the Tea Party, I'm sure, would say, well, just don't give as many people health insurance. But, that's not acceptable, and that's, if they, whatever. If the Tea Party wants to, say, not tax the device industry and instead, tax millionaires, well, that's fine.
Right.
I don't think
right.
they're going to do that.
And sort of a sidebar to this is there's been, I think, a decent amount of research, as far as I know, and I'm thinking about that sort of that piece that Atul Gawande wrote some time ago about the two towns in Texas, that a lot of times these devices end up increasing the cost of medical care because as they're owned by doctors, they start to use them a lot more than is medically required because they own them. And I guess, when you've got a hammer, you look for a lot of nails.
Yeah, I know. I'm really glad you made that point, actually. I mean, the sort of broader context of all these changes you hear about in the healthcare law, when you hear about, there are cuts to the device industry, cuts to the hospital industry, drug makers aren't making as much money. And they will all complain about these, even if they've agreed to them. We're taking these hits where we might have to lay off workers. And, it is a hit. They are getting less money. But that's sort of what we're trying to do here, right? And we all say we want to spend less money on health care. Well, if you're going to spend less money on health care, you actually have to spend less money. I mean, you have to take the money from somewhere. And the idea here is that in the context of all the other changes taking place in as part of the Affordable Care Act, because remember, there's all these incentives to sort of be smarter about the way we do healthcare, to coordinate efforts among different practitioners to sort of make sure people are sort of getting continuous care and they know what they're more information about what works and doesn't work. The idea here is eventually that we don't we're a little smarter about what we pay for, and so we should be spending less on the device industry. And the idea is as the sort of pressure by applying pressure to these different industries, and as their margins go down, the hope is in part they'll react by saying, look, we're getting squeezed. If we want to make a profit, we're going to have to be more efficient. So let's figure out how to do a better job here. And ideally, you end up with the best of both worlds, where you're spending less money and you're getting better medical care.
And in many respects, I mean, that's the ultimate theory for better or for worse. And I think there's very legitimate arguments that these things don't go far enough. And I'm one of those who would have liked to have seen a single payer type of system, which would have been far more efficient, I think, in many respects. But that's what the legislation is intended to do: set up a series of sort of small marginal reworking of incentives within the industry to drive down cost.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. This is the whole idea, and I'm a single payer fan like you are. But in the absence of that kind of effort, this is another way to lower costs. And actually, even a single payer plan, in effect, might do something like this. I mean, in principle, it's a similar idea of sort of basically saying to the people who provide healthcare, okay, look, we're not just going to write such big checks to you. We're going to be more careful about that. We're going to, you know, and we're going to press a little harder on the prices, and we're going to kind of look for you to kind of provide better results. And that's, you know, that's what the law is trying to do. And we're starting, you know, whether it works is something we're not going to know for 10 or 20 years. There's no way to know for sure. This isn't that easy to detect. But you can pick up little signs here and there. And all the signs that are out there right now actually suggest, hey, this might actually be working. You know, how well remains to be seen. But there's lots of, you know, bits and pieces of data and anecdotes out there to suggest that this approach to controlling costs is starting to take effect. And, you know, people don't notice it because it's money that they're not spending. You know, someone tells you you would have spent $10,000 more, you know, for health care. Well, you're not going to notice that. But it's true. You actually, that's money you're not spending.
And in fact, that's one of the biggest challenges about health care reform in general, it seems to me, because you're talking about 20% of the population bearing 80% of the cost. Or needing, I guess, 80% of the expenditures for healthcare, people don't realize the some of the changes that are going to be taking place in healthcare writ large because they're not in a position yet to need their health insurance in a way that it will have been materially changed.
Yeah, you know, one of the weirdest things about the politics of the Affordable Care Act is that for all of the hype on, you know, to some extent on both sides, there's a very small group of people who are actually going to feel and see the changes visibly. You know, the vast majority of the country is going to wake up on January 1st, 2014. Nothing's going to be different. You know, they'll still be getting health insurance from their employer or from Medicare. You know, nothing will obviously change about the way they go to the doctor or whatever. They will be, I would argue, better off in any number of ways. There will be this changes behind the scenes that are making healthcare more efficient and less costly. They'll have the security of knowing that if they get sick or if they lose their job or if they, you know, experience some other kind of financial distress, they will be able to remain covered. But, you know, then at any given time, that's not that many people. And I think that's an interesting political lesson about how this will eventually all turn out. You know, I have a whole side of my family that lives in Massachusetts. And I was talking to them recently about the reforms there, which, you know, have been in place for a number of years. And they're very popular. I mean, nobody, you know, but it's not like people walk around talking about it. It's not like it has this sort of, you know, romantic pull like Medicare does, I think, because Medicare is such an obvious, tangible program. It's just kind of in the background. It's just there. And if anyone tried to take it away, it would be a huge problem. I mean, it's rock solid secure, but it's, you know, it's not, it doesn't have this salient political impact.
Right. I mean, it's one of those things that you don't really, you literally until you're hit by a bus or, get a horrible diagnosis from a doctor. It's not necessarily something that you're dealing with on a daily basis. I want to talk about the sort of the rollout and what has been good and what has been bad. But I have just a couple of small bore questions that we've been waiting to have somebody on. I mean, really small bore, but this is one that has been really vexing me, and I have not been able to figure this out. And I have to ask it, or my audience is going to take me to task on this. And this is incredibly small bore, but it's an interesting question. Under the new guidelines, there is guaranteed issue, which means that you cannot be denied if you have a pre-existing condition. What happens if someone has health insurance, they get sick, they are found to have lied on their application? I said, I was not a smoker, I'm a smoker. I lose my insurance because I've lied. Can that person then go out and buy insurance again? I guess in this instance, you know, sort of conceding that they're a smoker. I mean, are they still eligible for insurance under the guaranteed issue? What happens in that circumstance?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me say first that I have not looked into this specific question, so I'm going to give you my best guess answer. I can look it up for you and get someone to answer it for you, but this is one of those, you know, scenarios I'd never actually thought through. The two things I would say, first of all, let's just be clear the only questions about your medical stats or history you ever have to answer on a questionnaire starting January 1st, or starting now, actually, is about tobacco use. I mean, you know, this is, you know, used to, for the longest time, you know, it was you had to answer a 6-page questionnaire about your medical history, and if you made even one omission with no intention to mislead, you just forgot something, you could totally get in a situation where you got sick and they could yank your coverage away. This is not at all hypothetical. I've written articles about people like this many times, and there have been many others out there, and people who never thought they were doing anything wrong, just forgot an appointment, forgot a test they had had for something. 3 years later, they get a serious medical condition, and they end up bankrupt because the insurance policy carrier pulls their policy, and they're done. So that can never happen again. The only issue is the one you bring up is tobacco. The insurance companies are allowed to charge you more money if you're a smoker. So what if you lied on that and were discovered to have lied? You know, I don't know what happens in terms of immediately what the penalty is. In other words, my guess, if I had to guess, is I don't think the insurer can just yank your policy. They might be able to charge you back premiums.
Mm.
You know, basically saying you were supposed to be paying at the rate of a smoker, you weren't. You owe us this money. I don't think they can just yank coverage from you and leave you uninsured. The next year would come up. You know, the way it works, the way the new law works is if you're, you know, buying, again, this is all for people buying insurance on their own, we're talking about, not for employers. No, again, nothing changing for employers. If you're buying insurance on your own, the way it works is there's an open enrollment period every year. So I would assume, you know, the next year you would just buy a new insurance policy. And just like you would, you know, under normal circumstances. And, you know, obviously if you lied again, I think you'd be subject to the same kind of penalty. That's a good question. I'm happy to look it up and email you.
I appreciate that. It was just one of those questions that I had never contemplated.
Yeah.
All right, so let's one more question, then let's just get into sort of what we've experienced over the past 2 weeks of the rollout of Obamacare, or at least the beginning of the enrollment period. I've seen sort of sporadic reports of people saying that, you know, certain companies, Blue Cross seems to come up a lot, and I can't quite tell if this is just one of those, fraudulent email chains. Blue Cross has doubled my premiums because of the Affordable Care Act. I'm not seeing any taglines about President Obama being Kenyan, so... I've paid some attention to it, but what do you know about that?
Right. So I've seen those as well. There's a lot of Twitter stuff about that too. You're going to hear a lot about Blue Cross, first of all, with any kind of changes, because Blue Cross is the dominant carrier among people. You know, among people buying insurance on their own, more people buy Blue Cross policies across, and, you know, in the different states than any other policy. So if there's a change to insurance, any change to the individual market, we call it the non-group market in the land of healthcare wonks, the non-group, you know, as in not part of an employer group. If you're in the non-group market, chances are you're buying a Blue Cross plan, so you're always going to hear about Blue Cross. Every Blue Cross plan is different in every state. They're independently run, although they are part of a national association, so just to get those facts out there. It's hard to know what's happening, because I think a couple of different things are going on. It is true, and I think, again, you know, a lot of us have tried to explain this all along, that the way, you know, the market is changing dramatically for people buying insurance on their own. We're basically saying insurers, you can't lock out people anymore because they don't have pre-existing conditions. You can't charge them more because they're sick. Used to be insurers could charge tons more if you were older. Now there's a limit on how much they can raise rates if you're older. You have to sell to everybody, and you have to include a set of comprehensive benefits, and that's a really big deal, because there's a lot of insurance plans out there right now that don't cover stuff, you know, or they have very weak coverage on essential services, prescription, maternity is a big one, right? You know, if you're, you know, they basically, insurers will charge women much more than men and add maternity as a kind of extra, and a lot of policies they just won't sell maternity with. So all of that makes insurance more expensive. And that it has to, because you're telling the insurers they have to pay for sicker people than they would insure before, and you're having them provide more services than they were before. But, and this is the second part of the story, is the law then says, all right, that set of changes is going to make health insurance more expensive. We also have some stuff to make it less expensive. Actually, one of them was that reinsurance thing we were talking about at the beginning of the show. But more important than that are these tax credits and these subsidies, which, you know, knock down the price a lot. You know, we're talking thousands of dollars a year for some people. And what I think is happening with some of them, and I haven't had time, you know, I haven't had time to really look at any of these letters. What I think is happening is that Blue Cross is now telling people, hey, you were in this insurance plan. The insurance plan, we can't offer, they're either saying, we can't offer this insurance plan anymore because it doesn't meet the requirements. We have to give you a new one. Or we are still offering it, but, you know, we're offering an equivalent plan from now on. But the price has gone up. It's more expensive because now we have to cover people who are sicker and maybe we have to add benefits. Usually, I think what they then say is, by the way, you should check if you're eligible for a tax credit. And a lot of these people are. Most of these people probably are. And, you know, how much of a tax credit you get is going to depend on how wealthy you are. But, you know, in general, when experts have looked at this, the feeling is most people, more people should end up paying less than they are today, although some people will end up paying more. And it's going to vary depending on your circumstances. So that's what's going on.
And when you hear a company say, hey, you know, our insurance rates are going up this year, we are group insurance, but our insurance rates are going up because of Obamacare. They're basically just blaming the Affordable Care Act when, in fact, their insurance rates had gone up the years prior as well. I mean, is that generally...
I think that's generally... There's a lot of blaming Obamacare going on right now. You know, insurance rates are going up, it must be Obamacare. You know, it's raining outside, it must be Obamacare. You know, Red Sox beat the Tigers last night, which actually made me happy. You know, so, but if you're a Tigers fan, that was Obamacare.
I actually think Ortiz did come out and concede that Obamacare was one of the big reasons why he was able to hit that pitch so deep. So,
yeah, you know, Massachusetts, the Red Sox were big fans of health care reform there. So, but no, I think you're right. I mean, you know, and those Blue Cross letters, I haven't seen them yet, but I would not surprise me if Blue Cross is kind of going, you know, they're lumping everything in there. And they're like, oh, you know, your rates are going up because of Obamacare. And, you know, this happened. We've had a string of stories over the last year. And you hear about companies changing their health plans. And they say it's the ACA. You know, there was UPS made a change, you know, to what it was covering for spouses. And Delta Airlines made some changes. And they're like, oh, it's the health care law. But then if you actually get into the weeds and look at what they're talking about, it's not really the health care law. I mean, it is true the law adds a few, like for employers, there are some new costs they face, but it's also true that the law seems to be holding down costs in other ways, and the net impact is just really, really tiny. So if you're for employers, it's really not the big story here. And you know, for the individual market, again, for the Blue Cross plans, people getting the notices that, you know, their individual plan is going up or down, there the law is having a pretty big effect. But again, you know, make sure you're hearing the whole side of it, because there are these subsidies that are huge, and for, you know, many if not most people are going to wipe out, you know, the increase. And, you know, you're going to have a lot of people who are paying a lot less than they are today. You know, yep. You're going to have people paying less than $100 a month for a good family policy. And, you know, there are people who are going to pay more, and that's important to sort of be upfront about. And in general, it's going to be the people who are either young and healthy, so they get the kind of upside of the current system, right? Because, you know, the 28-year-old single man, you know, doesn't ever get sick, you know, gets really cheap insurance today. Or they have plans that don't really cover anything. Those people are going to have to pay more. But, you know, at the end of the day, I would argue those people are actually better off because they have protection they wouldn't have otherwise. You know, if they get hit by a bus, they get cancer, they're going to be protected. And in no cases that I've seen are the rates outrageous. I mean, even the higher rates are pretty comparable in general. You know, I haven't seen every rate out there, but, you know, they tend to be pretty comparable both to employer policies available today and what these people would pay for an equivalent policy in the open market.
And presumably, these people are going to continue to live, and by the time that they get to Medicare age, they will have saved significant money because these people are going to get older. They would have been subject as older people to higher rates. Some of them are going to get sick. They would have been subjected to either an inability to get insurance or higher rates, et cetera, right? I mean, so if you look at it over the course of your lifetime, this is a net positive.
Right. I mean, you know, if people get older, everybody gets old. Everyone gets sick eventually. I mean, you know, look, and there are people, you know, there's a certain random quality to this. There are people who go through their lives not needing as much medical care. They get very lucky, right? You know, you're one of the lucky ones. You never got a horrible disease. You never were in an accident. You live till you're 90-something or whatever, and then one day you dropped dead of a heart attack, and that's the end. And, you know, you not really cost the medical care system. If you're one of those really lucky people, then over the course of your lifetime, paying for insurance would have been a waste, theoretically, under, you know, some people might say, right? Because, you know, you didn't need it. But did you know you didn't need that? Of course not. I mean, that's what insurance is all about.
Right. We don't say that when our house doesn't burn down. And
right.
I've been carrying this fire insurance for all these years.
Exactly.
And I got ripped off.
Exactly. Yeah. Your house insurance is a total ripoff. Why are you paying it?
All right. So I know we're going a little late here, and I appreciate your indulging me. But I just want to touch on a piece you wrote on the first about potential Obamacare glitches and how many of those have borne out. Your number one was basically website problems. Now, people should understand there are essentially two sets of websites here. One is the National Clearinghouse, which is picking up the slack for about 36 states that did not set up their own healthcare exchanges. There are 14 states that have their own exchanges. It seems like the state-run ones are doing better because, of course, they're doing something on a much smaller scale. And I mean, is that your assessment?
Yeah, this distinction is really important, and you're like the only person I know who seems to be getting it. Which is, you know, if
I just
you
read
live,
what you write.
If you're in one of these states that are running it on their own, you know, and the states that, you know, you hear mentioned a lot, and I've been trying to, I haven't written a lot about this since the first because I'm trying to talk to people in all these places to make sure I know what's actually going on. But, you know, California, Connecticut,
New York.
Washington State, Washington, D.C., and of all places, Kentucky, by the way, which is the interesting story of them all. They've done a really good job, and if you go on the sites, you know, since they still are a little glitchy, you might get bumped out for some security thing or whatever. There might be a crash or two, but people are going through the system in a reasonable amount of time. They're buying insurance. I've tried all those sites just on the front end, because all of these sites allow you to just browse without actually starting to create an account. So even if you don't live there, you can check them out. They're great. I mean, it's really such an easy way to shop for insurance. I mean, relative to what it would be now. I mean, it takes a few minutes. You got to enter your income. You got to think about what the different plan options are. Those are working well. It's the federal sites that aren't, the ones that the government is running on behalf of states that opted not to. Now, I will say this. I think it is true that the burden of running 36 states was added to the management challenge that the federal government faced, and they were under enormous political pressure. This technologically, what they're trying to do is very, very difficult. I would agree with all that. I also think, to be honest, the more I hear about this, the more we're all hearing about this, I think, you know, we have to admit, I don't think HHS managed this well. I don't think the Obama administration managed this well. I think, you know, there we'll find out why. I don't think it was for lack of diligence. I don't think they were indifferent to it. I think they spent a lot of time trying to get it right, but they didn't do a great job. And, you know, afterwards, someone's going to teach this case, you know, in management classes and public policy classes. Why didn't, you know, the administration get the rollout of these websites correct? But, you know, I think they will get it correct eventually. If you think about the things that make this new healthcare system work, right? I mean, you need to know that insurers will come and offer reasonable prices, and you need to know that people will be interested in buying these policies. And these are things that if those weren't working, we'd be in real trouble because government can't just snap its fingers and fix that. But those things are all working well. The insurance prices came in lower than expected. Consumer interest seems to be higher than expected, which is what you want. So what we have is a technological problem. Technological problems are fixable, and they have time. Remember, the open enrollment period lasts all the way through March. Most people don't buy until the last minute anyway. We know this from what happened when they introduced the Medicare drug plan. We know this from Massachusetts. And by the way, both of those programs, they had plenty of problems at the beginning too. And they solved them, and today they work fine. I have every expectation that's where we will eventually be with the sites that the federal government is running. But, you know, they didn't do a good job, and I think it's going to take some time to iron out these problems.
From what I've read, it seems like there was the way that the government contracting took place here was they were going to a lot of sort of non-tech companies, but companies who used tech, essentially, sort of a whole cadre of consultants, you know, people who were basically selling them stuff that wasn't necessarily backed on people who just didn't know what they were doing. I mean, it really is sort of a classic case, and I've certainly seen it in, you know, corporate America. Air America had its own sort of boondoggle in its last in its last days with trying to build what should be a relatively simple news aggregation site. So this is not a shocking story, but it is certainly what's fascinating, of course, is that we're hearing so little about this because the Republicans stepped on probably their biggest public relations boon that they could have when it comes to Obamacare. They stepped all over it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talk about political malpractice. If I were a Republican strategist right now, I would be out of my mind because, you know, this, you know, they've totally stepped on this. I mean, I think it's going to get some bad publicity. There are going to be congressional hearings. This is going to be unpleasant, and it should be. You know, I mean, you know, we expect the government to work. I think we should, if you, particularly if you're a liberal and you run around saying government can solve problems, then you should have high expectations. And when government doesn't meet those expectations, you should be asking hard questions why. And, you know, what you were mentioning about the contracting, you know, one criticism you hear a lot from conservatives and you know, also from sort of liberals who I think, you know, study the way government works is that, you know, the federal procurement and contracting policies don't really, aren't always well designed. And, you know, I hear a lot, you know, everyone's got a theory on what's going wrong. So and I'm not an IT expert, so I don't want to be claiming to know more than I do. But one thing I've heard from a number of people, and you may have heard this as well, is that, you know, government, you know, the contracts tended to go to companies that were good at winning government contracts,
right?
Not companies that were good at building, you know, state-of-the-art websites. And, you know, maybe that was the problem here. And so maybe when this is all done, you know, one of the good lessons to come out of this would be, let's, you know, let's think about how we're doing government procurement policies, which is not something that's particularly sexy and probably not something that has, that liberals get excited about as much as conservatives. But, you know, maybe there's a point there. I mean, I think we should look at this episode hard.
The fact is, though, I mean, that dynamic exists across every industry that I have ever been associated with. It is always the salesman who will get not necessarily the best sort of person to do the job. And, I mean, I think that's a problem that it cuts across all industries. But I certainly, if you write a piece on that procurement, we will definitely have you on to talk about that. I just want
to learn about it.
I want to talk just quickly about two other things on that list. One is the navigators, because there has been, in this instance, the navigators are essentially third parties, usually sort of community or groups that have gotten contracts to go out and help people get into the exchanges. Very important for the risk pools, obviously. And there has been, it seems to me, a very concerted effort on the right to defund these navigators, to legislate them out of existence on a state level. Give me your sense of what's happening with the navigators at this stage.
Yeah, no, I mean, they've been the conservative campaign to undermine, to defund, to hobble the navigators. There's been nothing subtle about it. I mean, they've been quite explicit. And, you know, if you listen to the conservative press, you know, these navigators are basically armies of people whose mission is to lure, you know, low-income Americans into a life of, you know, government dependency and turn them into Democratic voters, except when they're also committing fraud and stealing these people's, you know, personal identity information to steal their money. That all sounds very hazy and kind of jumbled, but I actually think that's the way the right sees of it. It's just sort of all these ideas they hate. You know, it's very kind of Glenn Beck chalkboard style of pulling stuff. Oh, this is, you know, the old stuff about, you know, the new left in the 60s and, you know, getting people on welfare and, you know, it just all kind of blends into one toxic mix for them. You know, really what you...
They're
what
all
they
mini
are,
czars, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really what it is, it's a bunch of nonprofit groups like the United Way and churches who are being trained to go and help people figure out how to use the new system and get and make them aware of it. I mean, it's such a big part of this. There's so many people out there who just have no idea what this program is or that it could, you know, make affordable insurance available to them. That would be true under normal circumstances. It's particularly true with all the misinformation running around out there. And so, you know, these people are being trained to help, you know, so if, you know, if, you know, they work out of, they work in the places where you find low-income people or where you find, you know, or even not low-income people, just social service agencies, agencies for the, you know, a lot of elderly service agencies I know are doing this. And they're out to help people. And the idea is if they do their job right, more people will find out about the availability of insurance. More people will sign up. This is a good thing, you know, unless you think you know, giving health insurance is a bad thing. And I guess that's, you know, I don't, that sounds like a harsh thing to say. Who would be against making sure poor people or needy people can get health insurance? But, you know, I wonder sometimes about some of these Republicans who are trying to fight these navigators, what they really want to do.
Yeah, well, I for one don't wonder as much, but I know that you run in more polite circles than I do. One other question I had for you, which you didn't touch on in the glitches, is there is a program where there was some money, and I believe it ended up going to about 25 operations. They wanted to fund more of these, but the funding got stripped out in the 2011 debt ceiling fight, which was to provide seed money for nonprofit organizations to compete on the exchanges. They need seed money up front because, of course, they don't have anybody who's signed up for their plans yet, so they have a cash flow problem. These are co-ops, essentially. What do you know? Have any sense of how the co-ops are doing?
You know, I don't. It's one of those things I have not followed at all. I do know, and I was sort of pleased to see this, that there are a number of new insurance options cropping up in these exchanges. And in the bigger areas, in the more densely populated areas like Southern California, you have some interesting nonprofits getting into the mix. And, you know, again, I feel like this is one of those success stories that hasn't gotten a lot of attention but really should, because, you know, the idea of the law in part was to say, look, it would help this market, this non-group market where people are buying insurance on their own, it would help to have more competition. You know, it'd help if there were more insurers competing for business, and it would particularly help if some of the insurers who were competing were new, who were, you know, they're not like, you know, it's not just Blue Cross and Cigna and Aetna. You know, if we started getting people who had sort of, you know, different radical ideas about how to provide insurance and health care, you know, interesting models where it's more of a kind of team of providers and there's a lot, you know, a lot, you know, you have electronic medical records going back, you know, the kind of modern cutting edge stuff that you hear about if, you know, you read about what the medicine will look like 50 years from now. And it actually seems like that's starting to happen. There's no question that the amount of competition that we're seeing in the insurance market has grown because of the law.
And of course, if you have, you know, 25 nonprofits out there, I think it's in like 22 states. I may have the numbers off just a little bit. That was in some respects sold as sort of like a surrogate public option in some ways, because you have nonprofits functioning, you know, to sort of function some way like a public option would. I'm going to put on your assignment desk.
Assignment desk for next time.
Exactly. Well, Jonathan Cohen, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about this. The question of the debt ceiling and the continuing resolution is still very much up in air, and we won't know anything until we know anything about that. But I appreciate your coming on and giving us the latest state of the play.
No problem. It's a pleasure to be on, as always.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program. I should say, without irony, as we were talking about the technical glitches that the healthcare.gov has been subject to, that according to Kyle, our new server, this is a technical term, got borked, or I say our server got borked in some fashion.
Is that like borking or Robert Bork?
Well, I mean, borking, it stopped going. That's
wow.
You never
okay,
heard that?
That's, I didn't hear that before. That's cool.
It's sorry. Borked, and so I don't know that even people are being able to listen live on our audio stream today. This obviously is a malfunction. We're going in and we're fixing our server stream. If you're viewing on YouTube, obviously you can see this. Nevertheless, we will endeavor to be in better shape as we go forward.
Join us on YouTube. There's 193 people watching on YouTube. It's a great way to consume the show.
Yes, except for those people who would otherwise be listening on the audio stream.
I understand.
Are
if
not
you,
able
but
to
I'm
pick
saying
that up.
If you're in front of a computer and you're just used to listening to it on a computer, jump over to YouTube.
Yes, but the point is they can't hear us. So unless they can travel through the time-space continuum, they're not going to know that.
I take your point.
What do you mean you take my point?
I take your point.
I'm speaking into the abyss. I'm talking to people after they would have listened live.
I kind of meant for future reference.
And I will tell you this. Your memberships would ensure a rock-solid server. We would get our own dedicated server. We would have our own server farm. We would... Look, even the NSA, sometimes they have a little bit of a problem. So,
To defend Michael a little bit, let's say these 196 now people aren't usually all watching us on YouTube. So he's talking to those usual audio-only listeners who are now on YouTube who may have never before considered watching the show on YouTube.
Right.
So become a member today at majority.fm. We will never have to have another conversation like this. and if enough people join, we will cut this out of the archives, and you will never hear this conversation, even if you go back to listen to it. Of course, you can also support this program by buying your junk via our Amazon link at majority.fm. Click on it, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon junk there. We get a kickback, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Our sponsor, Credo Mobile. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. You can get a $350. I got an email the other day saying, I wish you had told us about this 2 months ago. I just re-upped on my AT&T plan. But folks, if you go to Credo, check your AT&T contract, find out how much you have to pay. If it is $350 or lower, Credo will give you a credit to your bill, your first and second bills, I guess. I'm not exactly sure how they do it. But they will give you a $350 credit so that you can switch over. And when you get there, you will get a 25% discount on your data for 2 years, and that is complete, total, unlimited data. Now, you know what Credo does. Through Credo Action, they give money directly to progressive nonprofits. They advocate on behalf of a lot of progressive political pushes that we talk about on this program. So if you're interested, check it out. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. We're going to take a break. We'll head into the better half of the program. You can IM me on via the app, even though our stream doesn't seem to be up. And you can call us at 646-257-3920 for those of you who are watching us live on YouTube. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey.